Hey friends, I hope you're all staying as safe and healthy and comfortable as possible, and that you're taking care of all the people and pets and plants that are important to you. We have a guest! Today I'll be speaking with the filmmaker Anna Biller about her debut novel, Bluebeard's Castle. Because this is the first time we've had Anna on the show, I'm sure there are folks listening who have never heard this podcast before. So to you new listeners, I say welcome. My name is Andy Mascola. I'm the host of People Are the Enemy. There are no ads on this program, and there is no Patreon set up for it. The only thing I've ever asked of listeners is if you love the show, and if you'd like to help support it and myself monetarily, and get yourself or the reader in your life some excellent fiction, please consider purchasing any or all of my books. I'm the author of 11 self-published novels that are all currently available worldwide in both ebook and paperback formats via Amazon. If you don't use Amazon, you can find all of my titles in ebook format at Google Play. Just search my last name, which is spelled M-A-S-C-O-L-A. That's how you'll find me on Google Play. If you've already purchased any or all of my books, thank you, thank you, thank you. I sincerely appreciate your generous patronage. And with all that out of the way, here's the quirky theme song. People Are the Enemy listeners, thank you so much for checking out the show. You are now rocking with the best. You are listening to episode 324, and our guest today is Anna Biller. Listeners may know Anna for her award-winning 2016 comedy horror film, The Love Witch, a movie Anna wrote, directed, edited, produced, scored, did the art and set direction, and designed the costumes for. This past October, Verso Books published Anna's debut novel, Bluebeard's Castle, a subversive take on the famous French folktale. In the original story, a wealthy alpha male with a beard so black it's blue has been married several times to women who have all mysteriously disappeared. In Anna's novel, which takes place in the present day, a successful novelist named Judith is swept off her feet by a handsome and charming baron named Gavin. Now, I promise I will not spoil Anna's book for those who have yet to read it. But obviously, there would be no story if there wasn't some trouble in paradise. And even if you already know the plot of the Bluebeard folktale, I promise you are still going to be surprised by the unexpected twists and turns in Bluebeard's Castle. Friends, I am an Anna Biller fan. I bought Bluebeard's Castle. I read Bluebeard's Castle. I loved Bluebeard's Castle. And I'll tell you something else. Other than having read Wuthering Heights, a couple of Anne Rice novels, and a lot of Edgar Allan Poe short stories, I am not a regular reader of gothic fiction. Now, if you're like me, and you liked Anna's film, The Love Witch, if you enjoy horror, if you enjoy erotic stories, if you enjoy romance, if you enjoy mysteries, if you enjoy stories about women in peril, I encourage you to check out Bluebeard's Castle by our guest today, Anna Biller. And now, I am going to speak with Anna Biller herself, if I can get her on the phone. Hang on one moment. Anna Biller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much for talking with me today. This is so special.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Anna, I'd read that Bluebeard's Castle originated as a screenplay for a feature film. And when the pandemic shut the world down, your partner encouraged you to turn your screenplay into a novel. Is the screenplay you'd written essentially a more concise version of your 370-page book?
It is essentially the same, but I was able to add a few things to the novel. So I think the novel's better than the screenplay was. And if I ever get to make this into a film, I'm going to add the new stuff and make it a little bit longer.
In Bluebeard's Castle, Gavin is often referred to as the Monster of Manderfield. And listeners, Manderfield is the name of the castle where most of the story takes place. I wondered, Anna, had you considered at any point naming your book The Monster of Manderfield?
No, that never occurred to me, but that would be a great title, in retrospect.
The original Bluebeard folktale was first published in 1697. So much of the imagery and language used in your novel made me feel, for long stretches, like I was reading a story taking place in the 18th century, and it wasn't until a character was sending a text message or using Instagram that I'd remember the story was taking place in the present. I feel like this tale would have worked regardless of when it took place. Was it important for you to have Bluebeard's castle take place in the present?
Yes, it was, because this is a story about a very modern girl and the kinds of problems that modern girls and women have. And so I did want it to take place in the present. But while I was writing the novel, I was reading so much 18th and 19th century Gothic fiction that I ended up just kind of putting all of that in there. And it, you know, the movie screenplay wasn't nearly as Gothic. It felt more mid-century, because the movies that inspired the screenplay were more mid-century films. And then the book got really Gothic, really 18th century Gothic, because of all the things I was reading. So I always like to get into what is a book? Like I want to make a real book. I want to make a real Gothic book. So I just kind of like leaned into everything I could in terms of the cliches, really, of the genre to write the story, to put it in the genre.
Because Bluebeard's Castle does take place in the present, along with your characters being able to use technology, you were able to reference books and films and actors. And listeners, if you haven't yet read Bluebeard's Castle, you're going to want to keep a pen handy when you do, or do what I did and use a notes app on your phone. And I say this because I walked away from Anna's book with a list of novels and movies I now want to check out. Anna, I have to imagine that narrating this story had to be fun for you, because unlike in a movie, you were able to drop a ton of great pop cultural references in the narration. Were there other aspects of writing a novel that you enjoyed that you hadn't been able to do, say, when making a film?
Well, yes. Well, the main thing is you get to get into the character's mind, which is almost impossible to do in a movie. You know, everything is implied, you know, the facial expressions, you kind of get a close-up of a face, or you sort of watch people and you guess what they're thinking, and you know, everything's implied. So I kind of enjoyed getting right into exactly what she was thinking, like going into her mind. That was really fun for me.
Were there aspects of filmmaking that you missed while writing this book?
Oh, well, no, I've been writing screenplays for so many years, and I just find the form of them really stifling, because they're not a finished work. So everything's about what you leave out. So you write a dialogue scene and you have to cut it into like an eighth of the length it was in order to fit it. Because your audience is, you know, they're not used to long scenes. You know, you're supposed to get in and out of a scene as fast as you can in a movie. So it just felt like such a luxury to kind of make a dialogue scene kind of long. it felt like, you know, that is actually more the convention of the novel, is to spend a little bit time with dialogue scenes, to spend a little bit of time with description. So, yeah, and you can also spend lots of money that you can't spend. You know what I mean? Like when I'm writing a film, I'm always conscious of budget. So the way, you know, so the castle got, you know, gets a lot bigger in the novel. It has lots of more rooms, you know, because I always think, like, I'm not going to add another room. I'm not going to add another set. That's another set to light. You know what I mean? I'm not going to do that. That's like another, you know, I'm always thinking that way. I'm always trying to like keep everything in a couple of rooms, you know? So, it was really fun to write the novel.
I have to imagine that when compared to all the people it takes to make a film, writing a novel, and obviously you've written screenplays, so you know it's a solitary endeavor. But, you know, obviously there's a lot more words involved with the novel, again, compared to a screenplay. Did you miss the social aspect of being creative while writing this book?
You mean like the social aspect of being on a movie set?
I suppose, yeah. I suppose working with different people in
love working with actors. That's one of my favorite things to do, is to work with actors. So, but I don't know. I mean, I'm in pre-production for another movie now. It's not this one. And so I'll be able to work with actors, you know, again pretty soon. So, you know, it wasn't like I have to forever, you know, not make a movie. So it was a nice break. It was a nice break from that. But it was also just, you know, I've been writing and writing and writing for years now without producing anything. So it was really nice to like have something I write be actually like out. Like it's like done, it's finished. I didn't have to shoot a movie. You know?
Sure. Sure. After reading Bluebeard's Castle, Anna, I found myself becoming attracted to the conspiracy theories involving the recent public absence of Catherine, Princess of Wales.
Uh-huh.
And then I found myself researching the disappearance of Shelley Miscavige, the wife of the current leader of the Church of Scientology.
Yeah. Anna,
you're so well-read, and there are 80 books on a shelf labeled Bluebeard on your Goodreads user profile, a lot of them fiction. But obviously my thinking in terms of real-life situations where women have gone missing, made me wonder, were there any true life stories or specific individuals who influenced your characters in Bluebeard's Castle?
Well, there are so many Bluebeards around. Once you start thinking in terms of like who's a Bluebeard, like there's a lot of Bluebeards out there. I read a lot of true crime fiction. There were a lot of real life Bluebeards that I studied, and a lot of them won't be people that you've heard of because they're just people like in the past, you know. I read a lot, and I don't even remember a lot of the names. You know, there's somebody like Larry Lord Motherwell, and obviously there's the more contemporary types of like serial killer types that we hear about. But you know, the other thing was, you know, I've known women who have been in relationships with Bluebeards, and they haven't actually made it out. I mean, here's the thing. You know, it was mainly based on that, is knowing a woman who didn't survive her relationship with a man like that. I mean, seriously, this is so common, you know. So I know that's very sad, but So it's just everywhere you look.
There's a term that's used a couple times in the book that I'd never heard before, and I wanted to ask you about it. It's called love bombing. And could you describe just what that is, if only because it was something that I read and I kind of had a picture in my mind of essentially, given the context of when it was used in your story, of what love bombing is. But how would you define it?
I think it's a term that comes from psychology. I'm not sure. But it's like something that narcissists do. You know, like fake seducer types do, to try to get somebody to fall in love with them very, very quickly. It's like a technique. So you just kind of like bomb them with love, like you smother them with love. So it's like they don't really stand a chance. It's like it's like an attack of love. That's almost like a war, where you're waging war on somebody to cause them to fall in love with you so deeply that they don't know whether they're coming or going. You know, and it's an abuser's tactic to try to get something from somebody through love. So like con artists use it, you know, like there are gigolos that might, you know, they might start dating an older woman and just, you know, they want to like take all her money, you know, they'll do that. They'll love bomb her, you know, that kind of thing.
Was it hard to get in the mind of the villain of this story? Was it hard to go there for you?
Well, like strangely enough, it was very natural for me because of maybe reading a lot of stories, but also knowing, just, you know, you meet people throughout your life that are like, you know, I've met my share of Bluebeards. Not that they're actually killers, but, you know, people who are narcissists, who are shady, who are dishonest. And you sort of like try to think about that, like the conversations you've had or the relationships you've had with people who are dishonest, or who are kind of appalling. You know, everybody's met people who were really appalling, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's I think one thing that I noticed you'd done really well in the book, and this was I believe also part of the book's summation, I think either on the Verso page for it or the Goodreads description, but it talked about how the Gavin character can be very cruel, but he can also be extremely charming and then twist that to his advantage. And then I suppose, and again, the dialogue between the Gavin character and the Judith character, we can see how Judith would basically talk herself back into forgiving Gavin for his horribleness. But I thought you did that exceptionally well.
Yeah, and that's like something people do when they're in relationships with people they love and they're hurt by those people, is they tend to try to figure out a way to continue to love those people. Because it's very hard, like when you love someone, it's very hard to abandon them. You know, like when you really love someone, you know, let's say it's like your child and, you know, the child did something really, really, really bad. You know, you can't really like just say, well, that's not my child anymore. They're dead to me, you know, and some people do that. But most people will try to find a way to forgive the child and to welcome the child back. And they'll kind of, you know what I mean? They'll kind of find a way to make it like it wasn't that bad. But you try to see the child's point of view. You know, people do that all the time. But people are much less forgiving of women doing that with a man they're in love with. You know, people kind of forgive, like, a woman, like, she forgives her child, parent forgives a child. But people often blame a woman when she loves a man and tends to try to forgive him or save him. They say the woman is so stupid. Like, how can she be so stupid? Well, it might be that she's got some positive qualities that aren't stupid. Like, she's got some, like extreme compassion, maybe. You know, some real love, some real compassion, some real forgiveness, some really good qualities. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
To not give up on someone. And then there are times when you stick with someone, you don't give up on them, and they turn around. I think like romance novels are sort of based or to sort of hinge on that. The idea that the woman believes in the man who seems like a terrible man, and then she's able to turn him around. Like there's this fantasy that the bad man, the brooding man, the man who seems like the worst man in the world turns out to be the best man in the world. But that's also the basis of the thriller, right? The thriller is based on this concept of, is this the man of my dreams or is he going to murder me? Right?
Yes.
Like the women's thriller is based to sort of on that, hinges on that.
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that also, as my next question was about this Margaret Atwood quote, and I think you may be familiar with it. It goes, quote, men are afraid that women will laugh at them. Women are afraid that men will kill them, end quote. Do you think this is true?
Well, yes, of course it's true. And it's why women are so careful around strange men. It's also why women end up agreeing to a lot of things and consenting a lot of things that they may not really be interested in order to peace. Like so with animals, you know, bigger animals are always you know, smaller animals are always having to appease bigger animals, that kind of thing. So when, you know, it's like there's women are constantly appeasing men because they're afraid of men, and so it takes a while to build up enough trust to trust a man, let him into your heart. And once a woman does that, you know, often that's it. She's gonna stick to that man and she's gonna see it to the bitter end, no matter what that end is. And all these romance novels are telling you that that's always the right thing to do, because it will always work out well. But, you know, what I'm seeing is that, you know, women who cling to a bad man and they keep clinging, you know, sometimes they maybe need to like let it go. You know what I mean?
Sure. There was another quote that I find myself thinking about every now and again, and it was brought to the surface of my consciousness while reading Bluebeard's Castle, and it's this one by Bret Easton Ellis, who wrote in American Psycho, of all books, he wrote, quote, is evil something you are, or is it something you do, end quote. Do you think evil is something a person is, or is it something that they do?
I mean, it can be both.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like, it's like the attitude has to precede the action. I think it's sort of the worldview. Like, you know, I read a lot of psychology, and there's this psychologist, Alfred Adler, that I'm very interested in, and he writes a lot about narcissism and about neuroticism. But one thing that he says is, like, a lot of people who have these kind of narcissistic patterns, they have a different worldview, you know? So it's like the worldview is like that they're entitled to more than other people.
Yes.
You know, that they, and so if you have that worldview, that's kind of an evil worldview. Like if you stick with that worldview, that does make you evil.
Yes. Yes. I remember.
You know, so like this man, Gavin, like his, you know, personal comfort is worth more than a woman's life. Because he thinks that, then that he is evil.
Yeah, and he doesn't seem to have much empathy at all.
Right, because toxic narcissists believe that they have more rights than other people. That they're comforter. You know, there are men who believe that their orgasm is more important than a woman's life. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like there's so that's an evil person. You know, that is just evil. That's an evil worldview.
For sure. For sure. While we're on the topic of empathy and animals, as you mentioned, and I wanted to ask you about cats. Animals are obviously important to you. There are horses featured in Bluebeard's Castle and The Love Witch, and the Elaine character.
Yeah, all my movies please. Have horses in them. Yeah,
is that
all
right?
All my movies have a horse. Yeah.
Do you think?
I have this other feature, Viva, that I made. It's got a horse. And then my first short film that I put out had a white horse.
Do you think this will be a you think a horse will feature in your future films also? Is this going to be something that you...
Oh, there's lots and lots of horses in my next movie.
Oh, fantastic. That's so great. Yeah. I was going to say the Elaine character in The Love Witch at one point recounts an anecdote about a cat she was very attached to. Although I don't believe there were any cats in The Love Witch. But the Judith character in Bluebeard's Castle during the course of the story has two cats, Romeo and Lovelace. Have cats always been an important part of your life?
Yes, they have, but I didn't really get to have, like, the cat of my dreams when I was growing up, so it was more when I was, you know, independent, and I got to, that I've been able to like, bring cats into my life in a more, you know, just in a very intimate way.
Yeah, so you have cats now, I assume?
Yeah, I have two cats, and the book is dedicated to them. Their names are Jacques and Claudius. Jacques is a tuxedo. And Claudius is a really big, like an 18-pound tabby.
Wow.
And they're really great.
Excellent. Excellent. Anna, this has been so much fun. Thank you so, so much for talking with me today. This is so special.
Thank you. The time just flew. I really enjoyed talking to you as well.
Yeah, you're a wonderful guest, and I really appreciate it. At this point in the show, I'm going to hand things off to our friend, Rachel from Des Moines, and she is going to give you the char chat. So, without any further ado, take it away, Rachel.
Thanks, Andy. Hello, and welcome back to Rachel's Chart Chat for another week. Thanks to everyone who listened last week. I got some nice comments from Sherry, Jill, Jeffrey, Tavy, Bob, Mary, and Bill. Bill runs debuting this week on Blue Sky and shares the singles which reached the Hot 100 on that date in history. A great follow if you're on that Blue Sky platform. This week, let's conclude Rob Sheffield's list of 10 British bands too British for Americans to understand. To recap from last week, we heard about Muse, Manic Street Preachers, Suede, aka the London Suede, Happy Mondays, Status Quo, and Robbie Williams. Number 7, Scott Walker. Sheffield's assessment of Walker is not understanding why, quote, credible UK rock stars keep raving about what a genius he is. Scott Walker is an interesting choice for the list because he's not British or from the UK at all. He was born Noel Scott Engel in Hamilton, Ohio, near Cincinnati, and his oil exec father moved the family around the US before settling in California in 1959. I must admit I had not heard of Scott Walker, other than from presumably reading this list when I bought the magazine in 2004, until his death in March of 2019. Walker Nay Engel had been involved in showbiz since childhood.
In 1964, at age 21,
he formed the Walker Brothers with two friends, all three taking Walker as a last name, from a fake ID that singer-slash-guitarist John Mouse had. The group's drummer, Gary Leeds, aka Walker, encouraged them to move to London. They found great success in the UK, with 10 hit singles, including two number ones, and their popularity rivaled even that of the Beatles. The Walker Brothers had three Hot 100 appearances in the U.S., notably The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore. You might have heard that in the movie Seeking a Friend for the End of the World. Scott Walker went solo in 1967 and released several successful albums in the U.K., where he even had his own TV show. He was known for a distinctive baritone voice that some say David Bowie copied/stole. He started getting into more avant-garde and experimental music in the late 70s after a revival of the Walker Brothers group. Over the years, albums such as Climate of Hunter, Tilt, The Drift, and Bish Bosh brought critical acclaim and influence to many musicians and fans. In 2014, Scott Walker made his first appearance on any U.S. chart since his Walker Brothers days. A collaboration with drone artist Sun, called Soused, reached number 88 on the 200 albums chart. As mentioned, Scott passed away in 2019, but with his death came a renewed interest in his music and many new fans. Number 8, Primal Scream. Sheffield states that their only U.S. fans are old hippies and that Primal Scream, quote, seem like a grumpy bunch. Primal Scream formed in Glasgow, Scotland in 1982 by Jim Beattie and Bobby Gillespie. The group is still together today and Gillespie remains the only consistent member. He was also dually in the Jesus and Mary Chain in the mid-80s. After a few non-album singles, Primal Scream released their debut LP, Sonic Flower Groove, in 1987. Then they hit big with their third album, Screamadelica, in 1991. This went double platinum in the UK, producing five hit singles there, three of which made the US Modern Rock Tracks chart. Moving On Up hit number two on that chart. The follow-up album, Give Out But Don't Give Up, produced the hit Rocks, which hit number 16 on the Modern Rock Tracks, as well as number 7, Bubbling Under the Hot 100. This song has been played on the VJ Big Suit Show. I felt it's very recognizable if you lived through the 90s. He also has played the Camper Van Beethoven Matchstick Men. As a reminder, that's twitch.tv/bigsuit, streaming 8 to 10 Central Time on Tuesdays. Primal Scream's most recent album of new material was 2016 Chaosmosis, and they were on the UK singles charts as recently as 2008. Number 9, Paul Weller. Sheffield says that since there's only 6 or 7 mods in the US at any given moment, no one can figure out what Paul Weller is saying. Paul Weller was born in Surrey in the southeast of England. Wikipedia cites an article in The Independent where Weller says seeing status quo in 72 inspired him to be in a band. He went on to be in two successful bands, The Jam from 76 to 82 and The Style Council from 83 to 89. The Jam had multiple albums on the 200 albums chart in the U.S., as did The Style Council, who also had a U.S. Top 40 hit with My Ever-Changing Moods. Weller began a solo career with his self-titled debut in 1992. One single from the album, Uh-Huh, Oh Yeah, hit number 7 on the Modern Rock Tracks chart. As of 2004, that was his only U.S. chart appearance, and meanwhile, in that time, Weller had 20 singles hit the U.K. chart, all but one in the top 40. To date, he's had 38 UK hit singles, including 5 top 10s. His most recent UK hit was in 2012 for a single off the Sonic Kicks album, which made the US Top 200 album chart, his other solo appearance on a US chart. He just released his latest single, Soul Wandering, earlier this year. Number 10, Blur. Sheffield says, quote, in the U.S., Blur are simply the band who did that woo-hoo song. Rachel says, Blur are British Weezer. Blur formed in London in 1988 by Damon Albarn, Graham Coxon, Alex James, and David Rowntree. And that's the same lineup the band has today. They're scheduled to play at Coachella this year. Blur released their debut album, Leisure, in 1991, which spun off three singles in the UK, one of which made the U.S. Hot 100, There's No Other Way, at number 82. Blur reached the U.S. pop chart again with Girls and Boys, hitting a peak of number 59 on August 20th of 94. That was off their third album, Park Life, aka the one with the doggies. As of 2004, Blur had reached the U.K. singles chart 26 times, including two number ones. To date, they've charted two more, as recently as 2023, with The Narcissist off The Ballad of Darren. And about that woo-hoo song. Song 2, as it's known, reached number 6 on the Modern Rock Tracks, now known as Alternative Airplay chart, on June 14th of 97.
I believe song 2 was one of the casualties of Billboard's insistence on the physical commercial single release, which didn't get amended until late of 1998. But that's a topic for another week. Now that you've heard the full list, what other UK artists come to mind for you that are very successful at home but didn't quite make the same splash in the US?
For comparison, here is the companion list of 10 US acts not famous in the UK, from their perspective, by David Quantick. Phish, who only played England 5 times, all in the 90s. Kid Rock, who would go on to have a UK number 1 hit with the terrible All Summer Long in 2008, it was number 23 here. Dave Matthews Band, who is a true one-hit wonder in the UK. Their only charting single was The Space Between, which hit number 35 in 2001 over there. Mandy Moore, who charted the two exact same singles on the US Hot 100 and the UK pop chart, both doing better across the pond. Hootie and the Blowfish, who, according to the British phonographic industry, not only had their debut cracked rearview gold gold, the follow-up called, ugh, Fairweather Johnson went silver. Sidebar, my BFF Jill has a series on her Tumblr blog, Omaha Snakes, where she reviews and writes about the year-end Hot 100 charts over the years. First she did 1997 to present, and now is going back 96 to question mark. For 1996, she ran into some Hootie and the Blowfish songs and shared the following with me. I count it among the saddest realizations of my life that when Darius Rucker says that the Dolphins made him cry, he meant the football team. I just thought he was scared of the Dolphins or startled. End quote. In the 90s, I remember being 50-50 on the football team or like the idea of him weeping at the beauty of nature. Clearly neither of us grew up with access to MTV, because the video's sports theme and special guest star Dan Marino makes it clear which Dolphins he meant. For any listeners who heard this song in the Hootie heyday, what did you think Darius meant by that line? The remainder of the UK list, John Mayer, misspelled as a Bolognese last name, Grateful Dead, who played England 23 times and Scotland once, and they also released a box set of 1972 performances in 2002, Goo Goo Dolls, though it seems Iris was just as inescapable there as here, and they might not have been getting many free drinks in the US in 2004 either, Kenny Chesney, who hadn't yet married Bridget Jones, and Maroon 5, who Quantick bizarrely describes as twee, and goes on to say the UK doesn't need Maroon 5 because they already have Belle and Sebastian. This is one I might dispute, but to be fair, songs about Jane and the included singles didn't really take off here or there until 2004, when the list was written. Before we go, a quick correction. EJ, my friend EJ Fettis, was the one who suggested the ABBA Gold chart bump was due to a Glee episode, and if anyone didn't hear, the mystery of that was solved. It was an Amazon MP3 gold box deal for 99 cents on December 24th of 2012, leading to its number 36 peak on the January 12th, 2013 Top 200 Albums chart. A number of other albums that were a part of that deal also recharted that week.
That's about all from me this week. Thanks so much for listening. Back to you, Andy.
Thank you, Rachel. Awesome stuff. I really enjoyed that. As a big Scott Walker fan, that was a great, great summation of his career. This has been episode 324 of the People Are the Enemy podcast. Our theme song is Walrus Love by Nokia Ocean. You can find that song and more at pizzapuppies.bandcamp.com. My name is Andy Mascola. You can purchase my novels via Amazon and other online book retailers in both paperback and ebook formats for as little as $1.99. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you, Anna Biller. Thank you, Rachel. We love you. Peace.